south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, just a non-Latin American observation, just for a minute or two before we get into the good stuff. You know, now you longtime listeners know I've been on the fringes of rock and roll for a long, long time. I've done countless gigs and I've had thousands of great musical conversations with real musicians. And you know what? When the subject of great drummers comes up, you know whose name is never mentioned? Charlie Watts. You know, he just died. He was 80. Longtime Rolling Stones drummer, of course. I'm telling you, he's been around for something like 50 years, and I've never heard a single professional drummer mention him as any kind of role model or icon at all. Hey, he was adequate, all right. Had a soft touch, didn't stand out. But all of a sudden, since he's died, musicians in the media are falling all over themselves saying he was the heartbeat of rock and roll. Come on. You may have heard me say this before, but no one goes to see the Rolling Stones for anyone but Keith and Mick. And as far as people who say, well, he had that jazz influence that did something for the Stones that no other drummer could have. Bullshit. So now it seems like all the surviving great rock and roll icons are espousing their little sound bites about the guy. I mean, really, what else are they going to say? He was a decent, if not mediocre, drummer who could keep a good beat and got super lucky because he met Mick and Keith. Well, so could every unknown drummer in every unknown band that I was in. Oh, and there is something that people who have never been inside of a recording studio would never know. That almost all the early iconic Rolling Stones albums were recorded rather badly. The engineers in the studios just could not mic the drums very well. It was hit and miss all the time. In fact, if you listen to most albums recorded up to about 1970... I'm talking under the headphones now to really pick out the parts. There's just way too much ambient noise, and they're loaded with reverb. That was the way they did things back then. Reverb was often used to camouflage or obfuscate noisy recordings, sometimes bad technique and sloppy playing. Of course, there were a few obvious exceptions. Albums and drummers who were mic'd extraordinarily well. Like, for example, almost all the Beatles albums. Well, that's because they had George Martin as their producer, and he was a guy who recorded the London Symphony Orchestra. So that guy really knew how to mic percussion instruments. Triangle, timpani, kettle drums. Man, that guy George Martin had the magic touch. That's why Ringo's drums sound so upfront and distinct, even on their very earliest recordings. Oh, and Pink Floyd and the Led Zeppelin albums all were very well mic'd and pristinely produced. And that's because in the case of the Zeppelin, Jimmy Page was a studio musician for many years, and he knew exactly what needed to be done. And if somehow you don't believe what I'm saying here, have you noticed that a lot of, if not all, repackaged box sets from the classical rock era have a big stamp on the box and promotional materials that say, digitally remastered? Now, why do you think they would spend all the time and effort, money, and energy to do that? Because the original recordings were noisy and badly mic'd, especially the early drummers. Again, except for certain groups that had the right engineers and producers in the studio, like the Beatles, Pink Floyd, and Zeppelin. So anyway, Charlie Watts dead, age 80, nice guy, good drummer, nothing special. And until now, until his death anyway, on no one's top 10 or even top 100 world's best drummers list. Hey, I could be wrong, fans will disagree, but real drummers, when asked off the record, won't. All right, let's start out with an interesting email from down under Aussie, Ben. He says, "G'day again, Johnny. Question for you. And please don't take the piss out of me for being a do-gooder. I'm one of the lucky ones, I guess, who hasn't really been affected financially by the absolute frog shit of the past 18 months. So far, anyway." Yeah, right. You gotta love those Aussies. They have a way with words, don't they? He says, "Johnny, and I'll bet my balls there's people all over the place in worse positions than me right now. So my missus and I were thinking about sponsoring a child. But the idea of my money going to whoever needs it, I think the percentage is less than 100 that it'll end up in the place it was intended to go. And that does not sit well with me at all. So, do you know of any local schools or organizations along those lines over there by you in Latin America where we could help a kid get educated that would otherwise not have had the opportunity? Anyway, cheers, mate. Hope you had a ripper time in La Selva, the jungle." Signed, Ben from Down Under. Well, Ben, let me tell you, your little email opens up a big can of worms. By the way, I know some fishermen up in the States who open cans of worms all the time, and they say it's no big deal. Anyway, in fact, I'd say if half, 50% of the money donated to kids in Latin America for whatever good cause actually gets to or helps that kid, that'd be considered quite a success. In fact, a couple of years back, I really hit that subject hard on the show. When I once ran into a gringo backpacker, the kind of guy you notice if you're down here long enough like me, who isn't a backpacker because he's cheap, because he wants to get by on 10 bucks a day, but does it for the sheer joy of the adventure and the ability to mingle with people outside the high-end gringo hotels and resorts. You know, the whole backpacking situation is kind of funny because in no way are they all the same. I find a lot of European backpackers, for example, have really good jobs back home, and they get their month or two off for vacation every year, and they don't go first class at all. They prefer backpacking. You'd never know it, but a lot of them make over 100 grand a year, and they're only backpacking it, again, for the adventure of it all. They can afford first class, but they want to be in the thick of it, mingling with the real people. Unlike most American and Canadian backpackers, they're not tightwads or penny pinchers at all. They just like the adventure of it. Now, as for that small percentage of upscale American backpackers, you can usually spot them out because they've got upscale designer backpacker gear. They're sporting Land's End and Patagonia stuff, $500 hiking boots, graphite reinforced backpacks, $1,000+ portable tents, expensive satellite phones, etc., etc. And more often than not, high-end American backpackers look a little sharper, cleaner, and more pressed than your average backpacker looking for the cheapest eats in town. Of course, that's maybe only one out of 50 American backpackers, but they're out there. You run into them once in a while. Just like when you're at the airport carousel, you can easily spot the high roller travelers, or the wannabe high roller travelers, by their luggage. You know what I'm talking about when you spot the Louis Vuitton luggage next to your beat-up, no-name, duct-taped crap on the carousel. Either that person has money to burn, or putting on the dog and it's fake. Oh, and last time I checked, even a starter Louis Vuitton rolling suitcase runs around $2,000. Crazier yet, I know an extremely wealthy son of a Latino land baron who has a Louis Vuitton monogrammed travel wardrobe set. And I said, man, that must have set you back a couple of grand. He laughed and said, not quite. Try $23,000. And quite possibly for the first time in my life, I was speechless. And you gotta know the luggage handlers can spot the real thing in a second. And there's always a risk to showing off your wealth when traveling. Bad idea. And it starts even before you get to your destination. You might have seen those bad boy luggage handler YouTubes. I have. But one of the facts of life is lots of people have more money than brains. Or mommies and daddies with generational money to burn. But I digress. Where were we? Oh yeah, I was talking about a very nice upscale gringo backpacker I ran into some years ago. Turns out he was doing a Spanish immersion course, learning Spanish because he had been sending something like $50 a month to a charitable organization supporting a young girl in care of the agency for something like 10 years. He told me she was 5 years old when he first started sending the dough, and he'd correspond with her by mail in those days through this do-gooder charity organization headquartered in Central America, whose publicity apparatus extended up to Canada, where he was from. And he pulled out a folder from his backpack that contained all these nice letters from this girl in Spanish. Like I said, he was a good-hearted Canadian. Nice guys, those Canadians. He'd correspond with her every month or so. He wrote his letters up there and had them translated in Spanish. She'd send hers back to him in Spanish, and he had a university student studying Spanish translate the letters for him. Anyway, this guy had a whole folder full of correspondence and pictures of this girl who lived in a very poor barrio. So that $50 a month Canadian he sent her really gave her lifestyle and schooling a boost. So he said now that she was 15, you know, the 15 años thing and all that, he wanted to visit her pueblo. He wanted to surprise her, maybe throw her a 15 años party. Well, guess what? When he showed up at the location of the agency, it was a grand house with lots of late model SUVs in the parking lot. And inside, in the reception office, they had pictures of all kinds of little boys and girls on the wall, you know, people they were helping. And when he pulled out his folder and asked for information about the girl he'd been supporting and writing back and forth to for 10 years, he wanted directions to her pueblo. Guess what? There was no such girl. It was nothing but a complete scam, a fraud. And man, did that secretary have egg on her face. Apparently, North American gringos who donated a few bucks every month ever came down to check up on their investment. Though at first, they tried to convince him they couldn't give out that kind of personal information. And when he started taking pictures of the employees and the kids on the wall, the rent-a-cops threw him out. Man, that kind of stuff just makes you lose faith in humanity, doesn't it? In fact, I remember when I was going to Catholic grade school, I think it was every Friday, they had pagan baby hour. You see, the nuns in our class forced us to contribute our dimes and quarters every week to the pagan baby fund. And those pagan babies were located in Africa. Of course, we never knew or saw who those pagan babies were, and we really didn't know why they were pagan or what pagan really meant. But it felt good to donate a few dimes and quarters to the effort. It was my earliest taste of the do-gooder's high. And back then, there weren't any letters, correspondence, or photos to prove those pagan babies even existed. We just had to trust the nuns on that one. And you know, back when I was in Catholic school, we were deathly afraid of the nuns. They kind of gave us the impression they had a bat phone-like direct line to Jesus. But I digress. But man, let me tell you, there are tons of do-gooder groups coming in and out of Latin America. You see them all the time. Especially if you spend a lot of time at airports. You see them come in groups, matching t-shirts and all that. Their destinations are always the poor pueblos and towns in the boonies. They're on a mission, constructing buildings, sanitation systems, river and lake cleanup and recycling projects, solar outhouses for Jesus. Always busy little bees on a mission. Nothing wrong with that, however, when their time on the ground is up and they've had that final night round the campfire kumbaya party, they're back to New Jersey or Cleveland once again with a mandatory milk and cookies church group slideshow. So they get a second dose of the do-gooder's high by proxy. Hey, I'm all for doing good things for others. Only problem is, in most cases, if you return a year or two later to the scene of the do-gooder crime, most often the locals will have reverted right back to their old traditional ways of doing things. Recycling efforts petered out, garbage in the lake, the solar outhouse now being used as a chicken coop. Problem is, the do-gooder impact quickly fades because they're only in and out for a week or two and there's no follow-up. And that's what you need, repetition. And you don't get that. The effort and the impact soon fades. Do you remember in the 80s and 90s when Sally Struthers' Save the Children commercials were all over national TV? She'd be holding and standing around a bunch of malnourished kids, with stark close-ups of flies landing on little dark faces with big, sad eyes. She'd tell you how you could save a kid by adopting one virtually. Just sign up and send 5, 10, 15, 20 bucks a month to that particular charity. Well, 95% of all that is pure BS. Tell you the truth, I don't know why people keep falling for that over and over again. It's got to be that gringo savior complex, combined with first world guilt and the do-gooder high. People keep doing it, even though deep down they know most of them are scams. But it feels good to write that check and out of sight, out of mind. Come on, you know the score. Every couple of months you see a media scandal, whether it's the Red Cross, United Way, Salvation Army, March of Dimes, Jerry's Kids. Seems like every single big organized charity exists primarily to line the pockets and provide first-class perks to the administrators at the top. And if there's any left over, well, that'll go to the kids. Now, my new gringo backpacker friend, when he found out there was no kid, he was devastated. Never saw a guy look so sad, except at a funeral. I condensed that story. There's a lot more to it, but you get the point. Oh, and by the way, I know another gringo who came down and checked out a different charity and found the very same thing. So in the end, Ben, from down under, it's pretty much impossible to know for sure, especially when sending money from such a long distance, Australia to Latin America. The only time that ever works is when you're down here in Latin America and you've got boots on the ground and you know the people yourself. So I always say to first world people who want to help the locals, all of us living down here in one way or another do our part, you know. Practically every gringo and gringa expat I know help out their own cleaning ladies and maintenance guys and the kids and their families. And some gringos and expats even help some of the kids they run into here and there in the pueblos nearby. Take the case of Bitcoin Dan. He's had the same cleaning lady for around 10 years. She was fat when he first hired her, and now she's twice the size and diabetic. And after a few years, she couldn't even climb a stepladder to clean the upper cupboards, etc., in the kitchen. But Dan didn't fire her, no way. Instead, he also hired her 30-something daughter as a cleaning lady, so he's got two of them now, and one doesn't do a damn thing. She's way too slow and fat. She barely gets around, but she gets a full salary. The thing is, he knows his cleaning lady and her mother support an extended family, and he's going to make sure it stays that way. Of course, that's not all Dan does to help people. He also paid when the cleaning lady and her mother had to go to the hospital for various things. And of course, like most gringos who have cleaning ladies, he gives them clothes and old computers, bicycles, food, all kinds of things. Plus, he's got a couple of kids, so when they go on vacation to the beach, for example, he brings one of them along as a nanny, so that she too could enjoy something she could never possibly afford on her own. A free stay at an all-inclusive resort and get paid for it too. Anyway, Ben, you mentioned the great idea of giving a poor kid a leg up by paying for him or her to go to a private school instead of a really crappy Latin American public school. Well, that's a great idea, except I can pretty much guarantee that if you personally hand over the money to the father or mother, head of the family, with the dough specifically earmarked to send the kids to a better school, chances are it's not going to happen. They're going to find other things to use that money for, other important things. Could be a refrigerator, indoor plumbing, chipping in for Uncle Francisco's funeral, shoes, clothes, any number of things. Thing is, if you're not monitoring the situation, that is, living close by, you'll be counting on the fact they'll use the money for what you told them to use it for. But every family has its little emergencies. And the only real way you can guarantee the kids are going to go to a higher-end school is if you go down to the school yourself with the parent and pay the tuition right then and there. And, you know, realistically, that's not going to happen, especially if you're living 6,000 miles away. So if I were you, Ben, I'd wait until you've had some actual boots on the ground and have met some local families that could use some help. And there are plenty of them. Because I tell you, there's so much money wasted and thrown around by gringos and expats thinking it's going to have some kind of impact on the poverty situation. But the only time it really seems to help on an individual basis is if you hand useful things like bikes and computers, etc., over to people that you know or at least come into contact with once in a while. Not necessarily money, but items they can use. You should be concentrating your efforts on the poor people who live nearby you. If not, you might be throwing your money down the toilet or worse, like enabling a first-class lifestyle of some corrupt charity administrator. Bottom line, skip organized charities completely and be your own charity and administrator. Enough said about that. All right, now let's talk a little bit about gringos and expats trying to learn Spanish. You longtime listeners probably have heard me say that I'm a Spanish dunce myself. I didn't really understand Spanish much at all till I was down here about 5 years. I took French in high school and wasn't very good at that either. Just didn't pay much attention. But back then, anyway, you had to have language credits in high school to get admitted to college. Hey, we're all good at some things and bad at others, and I'm bad at languages in general. But finally, I did learn Spanish. I can still only maybe read and write at the 8th grade level, but that's enough. After all, most books, news articles, and blogs, in whatever language, are written not much beyond the 6th or 8th grade level anyway. So I can read Spanish language blogs, newspapers, and internet and magazine articles. But it's real hard work for me to read a Spanish fiction or nonfiction book. I don't even bother because it's not smooth sailing, it's drudgery for me. And I get no pleasure at all watching a movie or TV show that's in Spanish either. Especially a Hollywood or English language movie that's been dubbed. There's just no fun in that at all. So if you think, when you land in Latin America and you don't speak Spanish, that sooner or later, you'll get up to speed and your Spanish will be just as good as your English. Well, if you're lucky, that might happen, but if you're like me and so many other expats, even those of us who've been down here for decades, your Spanish aptitude will eventually hit a brick wall. Unless, of course, you happen to have been a Spanish major in high school or college. That means it's sort of your obsession or your hobby. Because I've seen this happen before. Someone comes down to Latin America, they've had 4 years of Spanish in college or high school. They've got great vocabularies and they know how to construct sentences. Their verbal Spanish communication skills might not be up to snuff because it depends on which country you land in. Because you're going to learn in the States Spanish as it's spoken in Spain. And almost no one here in Latin America speaks that way. Though some say the way Argentines and Chileans speak is pretty close. That's why, you know, if you, for example, learn your Spanish in Guatemala and take a trip, let's say, to Colombia or Puerto Rico, you might only understand 70 or 80% of what the people on the street are talking about. Then again, you might be a language natural, a whiz. Like some people are naturally good musicians or good singers or good ball players. But that's not the norm. Probably only 10% of people fall into that category. You can prove that to yourself next time you go to a karaoke party. You got that 10% that can really pull it off, and the other 10, maybe even 20 or 30% that absolutely make you wince. Anyway, regarding learning Spanish once you're down here in Latin America or maybe back at home in the States, we've got this pertinent email from Lynn Marie. She says, "Hi, Johnny. I hope you had a good time in your jungle travels. Just to let you know, another pusbag state worker here where I'm from. I work at the People's Republic of Oregon, where our illustrious governor, who isn't even a native and didn't grow up in our state, just issued another mindless edict requiring all state workers to get their vax by October 18th or face disciplinary action." Ugh. Anyway, Johnny, if I don't die from blood clots caused by the Johnson & Johnson vax, I'm going to retire in about 2 years. Being an organized, linear planner, I need to get busy learning Spanish so I can really be part of the Guatemalan community. I've tried to learn Spanish from home with not much success, and I hope you can recommend one of the Spanish immersion programs or recommend a tutor to teach me Spanish online. Thanks in advance for your help. Sincerely, Lynn Marie, a mom with a kid named Dave. Lynn, yeah? God, we've got so many Daves listening to this show. Who'd have thunk, huh? especially since growing up in Chicagoland, I think in all that time I only knew one Dave personally. Though I do remember this old senile Polish lady who asked me to cut her grass. She had a big lawn. I think she paid me $2. She used to bring me milk and cookies halfway through, and she'd call me Dave all the time. Turns out I didn't find out the whole story for a while. Dave was the last guy she had cutting her grass. Oh, and stop me if I've told this story before. Anyway, the old lady had a beautiful power lawnmower in her garage and one of those push jobs, Scott's. You know, they're expensive and nice, but a lot of work pushing that thing around. And she wouldn't let me use the power mower, only the Scott's hand push mower. Later on, I found out the last grass cutter, a much older boy, Dave, cut off a few of his toes with that power mower. A good enough reason for that old lady not to let me use it, that's for sure. Alas, poor Dave, he paid a heavy price, but it was a blessing in disguise because later on I ran into him. No, not with a lawnmower. And he told me it kept him out of Vietnam. But I digress. Man, did I digress. Anyway, Lynn, with your quest to learn Spanish and having given it a try a few times up in the States and not getting anywhere, I will send you right now a free copy of that Fast Spanish book, second edition. You longtime listeners might recall, I had an Expat Insider Seminar attendee go off on a personal mission through Central and South America to find the best, most economical, and efficient way to learn Spanish himself. By the way, any of you other listeners out there interested, I'll send you that book. Just send me an email, theexpatfinals@gmail.com. Anyway, the author, Jack, went on a language journey. The whole route. Tutors, classes, immersion families, he did it all. And as it turns out, not to be a spoiler here, he found out the best, most economic, and easiest way to learn your Spanish was in a little town in Guatemala called Quetzaltenango, otherwise known as Chela, X-E-L-A. You'll read about that if you get the book. Of course, there are lots of other ways and other cities to learn your Spanish quickly and efficiently, and he talks about all that too, as well as the pitfalls and the scammers. But let's say you're coming down to Guatemala in the next few months and you want to hook up with a Spanish tutor in person online or immersion family. Well, my expert, overqualified expat insider coordinator, Rita, can work out all those details for you ahead of time. So, Lynn, along with that Fast Spanish book, I'll send you Rita's contact details. You can do a signal call with her. She never charges for the call, and you can work out the details with her. Because, you know, the fact is, you can go online and find all kinds of Spanish immersion courses and tutors. But as Jack says in his Fast Spanish book, if you show up at one of these schools in person, you can pretty much cut 50% off the cost of arranging and booking the very same thing on the internet. In other words, you can come down and plan your trip and you don't even have to get a hold of these people ahead of time. You just walk up, knock on the door, introduce yourself, and start negotiating. However, it is a good idea to have Rita weed out the good ones for you beforehand. All right, now we have a little boots on the ground COVIDiot report from Mexico. For those of you who have heard that Mexico is quite loose on the COVIDiot requirements, this might give you pause to think that the media, once again, is lying to you. This comes from Carlin Mary. Says, "Dear Johnny, your podcast relating to our recent questions was great." Oh, I should mention they sent me an email a while back and I answered the questions on the air. She says, "Thank you. We're currently in Mexico City. The city is so lovely, sweet people, great music, food, reasonable prices, but the COVIDiot nonsense here is out of control. Masks are required everywhere. Temperature checks for every restaurant, hotel, tourist sites, etc. For example, Bellas Artes. To see murals of famous Diego Rivera, masks, sanitizer, and get this, full body spray with disinfectant are required. And flying back to the USA has been stressful too, with rapid test requirements and results sent to an incorrect email address. Not sure if we can jump through all these hoops again, but if we do, we'd love to meet up with you in Guatemala City, for example, in person for a consult and dinner if you're available. All the best, Johnny, from a former Chicago flight attendant and husband." All right, thanks for that little boots on the ground report from Mexico City, guys. By the way, it's a funny thing about Mexico City, one of the most populated cities in the world. You know, it's got around 22 million people, give or take one or two. So you're definitely going to find a lot of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great there. There's just so much variety. However, very, very few expats and gringos who end up living in Mexico, and that's certainly over a million gringos and expats there right now. Very few of them end up living in Mexico City. They almost always end up living where other gringos live. It's all about that soft landing thing, especially for people who don't speak any Spanish. But then again, the more gringos, the more gringo pricing. And in some of those touristy gringoized cities, the rents are higher than they are in New York or Chicago. But you knew that already, right? And the problem with Mexico City is they've got tremendous water shortages, terrible air quality problems and some of the worst traffic you've ever seen. But then again, just like Chicago or New York, if you live in the center city in a nice neighborhood, you might never need a car. You could walk to every place you want to go. Though, since Mexico is truly a narco state, I wouldn't want to live there. But hey, you could always live in a beautiful, walled-off, island-like paradise. But if you've got the dough, you can do that in any country. So my take on Mexico City, it's a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. Oh, and finally, here's a question from a great guy, Expat Insider Seminar alumni, Mr. C. He says, Johnny, can I use a Guatemalan vaccination card for a U.S. employer? If so, what poisonous vax formulation would that be? Well, Mr. C., you know, those rules and regs and what countries will accept and what they will not accept are changing all the time. For example, I just checked out the UK and they're not accepting Sputnik or the Chinese vax as legit. The thing is, though, in various Latin American countries, they're not just giving out one particular kind of vax. In fact, in Panama, I've checked out some people's vax cards and some have the AstraZeneca vax. Yet other people have a card that says they got the Pfizer. And obviously, the United States seems to prefer the Pfizer vax. Lots of clueless, upscale Latins heading back to Miami for that vax. You heard me talk about that in a previous show. So, Mr. C, if you're into getting a vax, and, you know, to each his own, right? If you can find a clinic that's doing the Pfizer, then, of course, the U.S. will accept it, because that seems to be the lunatic standard of care in the States. But it seems countries are shuffling the deck all the time, so what might be accepted today might not be tomorrow. It's something you can't nail down. You have to check it day by day, or at least week by week. I mean, look, you're seeing in the lame street media all the time that the Pfizer is 90% effective, which is all BS. You should see the criminal way they calculate those numbers. And then you see that the Johnson & Johnson vax is only 55% effective after 3 months, whatever. You can't believe anybody. It's all bullshit. So again, you just have to figure whatever vaxes they're giving out in the States. If you get that same one in Guatemala or any other Latin country, U.S. employers will accept them. Only you do know that those shots are not really vaccinations at all. They're genetically manipulating your DNA, forcing your cells to make spike proteins all the time. Very dangerous, but you knew that already, right? If you don't believe it and really think they are vaccinations, how come after you are vaxxed, you still have to wear a mask? And how come if you're vaxxed, if you travel by plane, you still gotta get a PCR or rapid antigen test? And don't give me this BS about you need to wear a mask because of viral shedding. Please. When you got your polio, smallpox, or diphtheria vaccination, or any of the 40 or 50 vaxes kids get these days, why aren't they forced to wear masks after those jabs? According to the science, everyone who's been vaxxed sheds viral particles.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.